Faraj. May Allah hasten the reappearance of Aima, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
Years after every internal event or presidential election, the West, its allies and agents in the region and beyond have bet on the future of the Iranian Islamic Revolution, which has so far defied all internal and external calculations. This revolution has proven itself once again after the election of reformer Masoud Pezeshkian as president, demonstrating its ideological and political maturity despite all the dangers it has faced over the years. The message sent by President-elect Pezeshkian to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, addressing him first even before taking office, aimed to show the entire world that the revolution remains steadfast and any bets against its principles are bound to fail now and always. President Pezeshkian's second message to the head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, reaffirmed the unwavering stance of the Iranian Revolution in supporting the central cause for all Arabs and Muslims, which is Palestine. The phone calls between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Russian President Putin, and Chinese President Xi Jinping with President-elect Pezeshkian came to confirm the continuation of Tehran's strategic approach in its relations with its allies. Without them, Iran would have been in a tougher situation. And without Iran, they would have also been in a difficult position, especially at this stage facing complex and serious regional and international challenges due to the situation in Ukraine, the imperialist colonial Zionist conspiracy against the Palestinian people with their divine patience. As for Western diplomatic circles, they expect, even wish, for President Pezeshkian to open channels of dialogue with Washington and Western capitals, as he promised during the election campaign, aiming to return to the nuclear agreement. They suggest that Washington will require Pezeshkian to show some lukewarmness in Iran's relations with both Beijing and Moscow, forgetting that it was President Trump who withdrew from the nuclear agreement, not Tehran. It was Tehran that faced hostility from Washington because it resisted and thwarted the imperialist West's plans during the so-called Arab Spring years. If those plans had succeeded, Iran would have also found itself in an undesirable situation due to the conspiracies of the imperialist West and its allies in the region. Regardless of the speculation about Iran's future policies under its new president, one thing remains evident. Imperialist, colonial, and Zionist agendas persist in manipulating Arab and Islamic public opinion. These forces continue to sideline critical issues that have long been the primary source of suffering for the region's peoples. Meanwhile, Iran will continue to support the peoples of the region to attain full liberation from the fangs of imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The state and government in Iran have proven that they operate within an institutional framework. What the regime strives for is a strong state with influence beyond its borders and the ability to adapt for its interests. But will President Pezeshkian bring about radical changes? To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Mr. Tara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Satara. Now, amidst regional conflict and political upheaval, Iran's political system has demonstrated stability by actually electing President Pezeshkian. But the main question asked everywhere, especially on hostile Western mainstream media, is are there any radical changes with Iranian President Pezeshkian taking power?
Thanks for having me. As you mentioned, Iran has been very stable in the stability during even the things that happened after the passing away of our president, our foreign minister, and the other officials shows that Iran has a strong political system that does not that is not affected easily by the events in the not only in the region but also in the country. I think for any country that has a strongly established system does not witness radical changes when the heads of the governments change, because there is a framework, there is a basis, a foundation, a strong foundation that the executive powers as well as the other branches of the power work within that frame and based on that foundation. So while certain things are going to be very different with regards to both foreign policy and domestic policy, we're not going to see radical changes because Iran is a stable country with a very well-established political system. And, you know, we had the snap election, we lost our president, our foreign minister. This was chaos enough for many countries to go through, but for Iran, we had a very peaceful transition of power, and which is still going on. And we held our elections for two different rounds, and the country elected their new president.
Mm-hmm. Well, Satari, we did see that Mr. President Pezeshkian reaffirming the strong stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran beside regional resistance factions, namely Hezbollah and Hamas, which really is the very big concern for the West right here. They want to support both Hamas and Hezbollah in their fight against Zionist Israel, and they want to stick to that support. Did the Iranian public ever doubt during this transitional period that this will be the case with the soon adopted foreign policy, that they will shift maybe, or that they knew that their government will just stick to its foreign policy?
Well, the majority of the people know that this is one of the main principles of Iran's foreign policy, and the Iran's support for resistance will never be wavered. It's going to continue no matter who becomes the president, because all these presidents believe on those principles that the country upholds. So I think the majority of people knew, and there were no doubts about it, but their concerns may be about how the new president is going to establish alliances and relations with the other countries in the region that would, in a way, affect Iran's support for the resistance groups. But whether or not Iran would continue to support the resistance groups was never a question. And mm-hmm. That's a given fact that we all know about Iran's foreign policy.
I think the main issue was that President Pezeshkian is a reformist, and we did see many, he's the third reformist president, if I'm not mistaken, and we did see reformist presidents before him who continued to support. Nonetheless, even the support was greater at some point, militarily I speak, because it was during the years of the global war in Syria. So in that particular case, is there public support for it, or some people would like to see less of that support?
This is what the majority of the people want, because it's not only that we're offering support for another country of our, which is our friend, it's also a part of Iran's national security. Israel is not a threat only to those resistant groups and the countries of the region, but also a big threat to Iran's national security. And I mean, it tries to be, at least. We see that as a form of repelling the threats by Israel. I mean, Israel has been trying to create chaos and attack and assassinate, and there's a long list and record of hostility towards Iran and Iran's alliance with the regional countries and support for resistant groups is just part of that, that the people want to stay, and that's a part of our national security that people want to see continued.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Mr. Masoud Pezeshkian's presidency, what do you think are the prospects and challenges of for the Islamic Republic of Iran in potentially maybe trying to return to the JCPOA nuclear agreement? I mean, how might this administration approach negotiations with the international community in the event Trump again is to become a president, and he's the one who actually withdrew from the JCPOA to begin with? If he's back in the White House, what kind of strategy does President Pezeshkian has to approach this negotiation?
Well, when Mr. Pezeshkian was the member of parliament, in a speech he at the parliament, he mentioned that we cannot expect the U.S. to return, and we cannot trust the U.S. because it has once violated and breached its commitments to the deal. But during the campaigns, and that's what Iran has been doing, he mentioned that we need to find a way and work towards removing the sanctions in order to bring some economic ease to the country, because as that's the answer to your question with regards to what are the main challenges. One of the main challenges of the Islamic Republic right now and the new president is solving the economic issues and problems that the country is going through. And as a part of working towards that, Mr. Pezeshkian suggested that he's going to work towards removing getting the deal and returning to the JCPOA and removing the sanctions. However, we need to know that right now and for the past months, there is a negotiation team by late President Mr. Raisi that has been working on confidential negotiations through Oman to see how or if it's possible for the U.S. to return to the deal. And they're working with the other European and with China and Russia, the now formerly 5+1, but now 4+1 group. They're working to see what is the mechanism, what are the procedures to revive the JCPOA. But to be honest, it looks like the U.S. has no intention and is dragging its feet. So this is going to be a main challenge, reviving the JCPOA without the U.S. And making sure that the European partners will actually stay or abide by their commitments, because they also failed. I mean, the U.S. withdrew, but the European partners of the deal also failed to abide by their commitments. So this is going to be a main challenge on the foreign policy, especially that has been promised to the people that he's going to work towards that, and that's going to bring about some major changes in the economic situation of the country.
In 1 minute, if that doesn't work, what other plan does Mr. Pezeshkian have?
Well, I think by now, because we have the experience of trying to reach a deal in the first place, and then seeing Trump withdrawing from the U.S., withdrawing from the deal, now the president-elect has a more like he's relying more on domestic capabilities and on forming alliances with other countries. That's also what he has mentioned, that he's not going to focus on only forming alliances or reaching a deal with the West. He's going to work with Eastern partners and partners from the global South to see how it could help with developing Iran's economy and bringing about more economic ease.
Well, Sitara Sadiqi, political commentator and co-host of Twice Told Tales podcast, thanks a million for being with us to explain how things are going after the election of the new president, Mr. Pezeshkian. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the shattered Zionist economy.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Israeli businesses have been forced to shut as a result of the ongoing war and its devastating effect on the economy. Hebrew newspaper Maariv reported on 10th of July referring to Zionist Israel as a country in collapse. More details in the following report.
Since the genocidal war in Gaza began, thousands of businesses have shut down in Zionist Israel, intensifying the economic crisis in the occupation entity. Zionist Israeli Kofas BDI, a company specializing in business information and credit risk management, reports that since October 7, 46,000 Israeli entity businesses have closed their doors. Yoel Amir, CEO of Kofas BDI, explained to Maariv, a Zionist daily newspaper, that this high number spans many sectors. About 77% of these closures, roughly 35,000 businesses, are small enterprises with up to 5 employees. According to Kofas BDI's risk rating, widely used by companies in the Israeli entity economy, including the banking system and international credit insurance companies, the construction industry and its ecosystem, ceramics, air conditioning, aluminum, and building materials are the most vulnerable. The report estimates that by the end of 2024, around 60,000 businesses in Zionist Israel may close. The crate sector, encompassing fashion, footwear, furniture, housewares, and services like cafes, entertainment, leisure, and transportation, has been hit hard. Additionally, the tourism industry is suffering from almost no foreign visitors, worsened by declining national morale and tourist areas now resembling combat zones. The agriculture sector, predominantly located in confrontation areas in the south and north, also faces manpower shortages. The economic damage is extensive. When companies shut down and fail to meet their financial obligations, the effects ripple out to impact customers, suppliers, and others within their ecosystem. Since the beginning of 2024, the Israeli regime's budget has recorded a cumulative deficit of 26 billion shekels, equivalent to about $7 billion. According to Maariv, the monthly budget deficit in March alone reached 15 billion shekels, or about $4 billion U.S. dollars, equating to 6.2% of the GDP. Moreover, the war has pushed Zionist Israel's debt to record levels since October 2023, reaching $43 billion U.S. dollars by April 2024, a figure that has doubled according to the Ministry of Finance of the entity. According to the data released by the Bank of Israel in late April 2024, Zionist Israel's war on the Gaza Strip has cost the occupation at least $67 billion so far.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Younes. He is an expert in economy, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and educational leadership. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Younes. Now, how does the closure of 46,000 businesses since the beginning of the war impact the long-term economic stability of Zionist Israel?
Yep. Thanks a lot for hosting me, Dr. Marwa. Actually, when we talk about the genocidal Israeli war on Gaza, we can't only take the aspect of what's happening in the battlefield or the military aspect. There is a war of narratives, and the resistance movements are having the upper hand in the war of narratives. The Israeli movements are having the upper hand in the military field, and apparently the resistance movements are having the upper hand from an economic perspective. What's happening in Israel is definitely an economic collapse. We have witnessed a slow growth in the economy. There are 46 businesses closing. The number is expected to grow to reach 60,000 businesses by the end of the year. This has a great impact on all the economic indications in the country, talking about inflation, recession, talking about the ability of the Israeli regime to attract capital. We are witnessing capital flight because the appetite of the international donors is decreasing. The credit worthiness of Israel or the Israeli entity is is diminishing to a record level. So the ranking of the Israeli economy has an impact on its credit worthiness. And the 46 businesses which are closing are mostly are from different sectors, mm-hmm. from all the sectors that you can imagine. And mostly they are small and medium enterprises. And these SMEs or small and medium enterprises, they are the backbone of any economy. So entrepreneurs are not investing in Israel. And the big donors are not sending enough capital to Israel. And if they are sending these gifts or donations, these gifts or donations are not invested in the right sectors. They are invested in immediate relief and not in infrastructural projects which are highly needed in Israel. And they are only for expenditure purposes and not for reinvesting purposes. Mm-hmm. These indicators are very negative in any economy. They are the indicators of developing countries rather than developed countries. And Israel always claims to be a developed country. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about business closures. We are talking about diversion of governmental spending. We are talking about decrease in the foreign investment, mm-hmm. the hesitancy of the developed countries to invest in Israel. Definitely they are hesitant because of this war. Usually when we talk about any organization, and I perceive a country or an entity as an organization, we usually talk about the goodwill. Israel is witnessing an unprecedented ill will. Mm-hmm. This ill will is due to the bad reputation. In addition to the military aspect, the bad reputation due to the war of narratives decreases the appetite of investment mm-hmm. and decreases the propensity of the major countries to invest or send money to Israel.
It's something quite interesting, Dr. Yunus, is that the substantial war expenditure has significantly increased Zionist-Israel's debt, reaching record levels with a $67 billion U.S. dollar war expenditure so far. How do you think that that will be translated on Zionist-Israel's internal fiscal health and probably also international credit standing?
Yeah. So the impact of this number, the $67 billion, is not only the $67 billion, which is huge and which is unprecedented. The problem is in the credit ranking or credit rating. Mm-hmm. Israel will face difficulties in getting credits or getting gifts or getting donations in the future. And even if they want to borrow money, the propensity of the international organizations to lend Israel money will decrease substantially due to this problem in credit rating. These economic problems, in addition to the military problems they are facing, have an impact on different levels. For instance, around the number of expected tourists to Israel was supposed to be 1 million. And they've received only 200,000 tourists. Mm-hmm. So a substantial decrease in 80%. And usually such countries rely on the expenditures of tourists to give an injection to the economy. In the contrary, these numbers, we're not witnessing them in Lebanon. The number of tourists in Lebanon and the number of the Lebanese, the diaspora, coming back to Lebanon
actually,
is increasing substantially.
Far more, it's increasing than the years before.
It's increasing substantially. So when I want to compare figures from the different aspects, military, economically, tourists-wise, narratives-wise, the upper hand is always being to the resistance movements, as you can see, Maru.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hassan Yunus, expert in economics, specialized in international business management, educational administration, and education leadership. It's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. Hopefully, we talk when liberation happens and we start talking about how the economy of Palestine will pick up, inshallah. Thanks a million for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do stay tuned on the Middle East stream next week for more updates. عظم الله أجركم بمصاب أبا عبد الله الحسين for the calamity that befell on Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The acceleration of the construction of settlement outposts hides a political goal. The Zionist regime authorities aim to fragment Palestinian geographical contiguity in order to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Palestinian residents of the village of Borga, east of Ramallah, are engaged in resisting attempts by illegal Zionist settlers to establish settlement outposts on their lands. The village is constantly exposed to systematic attacks from groups of settlers with full protection from the Zionist regime army, especially starting on October 7th, the start of the Zionist genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Palestinians living in the area noticed that the Zionist settlers' attempts became more frequent. Mohammad Sumrain, a resident of Borga, told the Palestine Chronicle that 9 Zionist settlements currently surround the village on all sides. There is only one way access to the village, where the Zionist regime troops often set up a military checkpoint. The main entrance to the village has been closed for more than 20 years, and residents are not allowed to use it. Sumrain told Palestine Chronicle that the last settlement outpost is called Tezur Harel and was established on the northwestern side of the village. Sumrain told Palestine Chronicle, in the beginning, illegal settlers claimed that they were herding sheep and prevented the people from approaching the area. He added, later we found that they had set up a tent, which turned into mobile homes and eventually into a settlement outpost. One of the settlement group's leaders in the West Bank, close to the Israeli Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is reportedly building roads for the new settlement outposts and providing them with the necessary services under full government support. In the last few months, Zionist settlers established three settlement outposts on the lands of Burqa. Meanwhile, the village has been repeatedly subjected to violent rampages by settlers, including burning homes and crops and destroying Palestinian vehicles. Somrain said at least 400 old olive trees were burnt by settlers over the last month. Those who established the outposts are among the most extremist and aggressive settlers in the West Bank. The outpost was established in an area of 4 dunams. However, Palestinians are prevented from accessing more than 500 dunams in its vicinity under many pretexts. The acceleration of the construction of settlement outposts hides a political goal. The Israeli regime authorities aim to fragment Palestinian geographical contiguity in order to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Hassan Melihat, the general supervisor of the Al-Baydar Organization for Defending Bedouin Rights, told the Palestine Chronicle that statistics indicate that there are at least 94 pastoral settlement outposts in the West Bank, 15 of which were established after October 7, 2023. These outposts have been built within the framework of a plan by far-right Zionist minister Bezalel Smotrich. The so-called decisive plan was announced in 2017 before Smotrich became a minister. It promotes settlement expansion, land seizure, and the annexation of the occupied West Bank. Melihat said legitimizing the settlement outpost is one of the main priorities of Smotrich's plan, which aims to purge the so-called Area C of the Palestinian population. He added, the plan aims to legitimize the pastoral settlement outpost and establish more settlements, especially on the eastern highlands of the West Bank. Additionally, it includes the creation of a settlement belt, which would transform the West Bank into ghettos and cantons. Since he became the Minister of Finance in 2017, Smotrich has worked to legalize 15 outposts. According to Al-Baydar, he formed a committee within the Ministry of War and produced a document listing the outpost that he intends to legalize, also setting a timetable. He said, an actual demographic battle is taking place in Area C. The occupation government seeks to legalize more pastoral settlements in order to create a different demographic reality in which the number of Israelis exceeds that of Palestinians. Melihat added, one of the most important goals of this strategy is that of confining the Palestinians to areas classified as A and B by the Oslo Accords. Eventually, Palestinians living in Area B will also be deported, he said. The location of the outpost is not selected randomly, but is part of a specific strategy. Currently, pastoral settlements cover nearly 10% of the entirety of the West Bank. Most of the settlement outposts are concentrated in the central areas of the West Bank to separate the north from the south and create a permanent fragmentation that would make it impossible for a Palestinian state to see the light.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are going to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws concerning magic in this episode. Well, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start with this question, Sheikh. What is the jurisprudential view on teaching, learning, and watching conjuring? And what's the law regarding performance or performing, in fact, illusionary tricks which depend on quick handwork?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the scholars and the religious authorities are agreed on the fact that it is not permissible to teach and learn magic. Therefore, it is actually haram to learn and teach or learn conjuring, which is considered to be a kind of magic. And Islam is strongly opposed to the practice of magic. You know, from the early period of Islam, when the Prophet and the Imams were actually alive, they opposed the practice of magic.
Yes,
because magic can be misused in many ways, and of course, magic can be used to trick others, to make others believe something which believe in something which they should not believe in. Of course. But when it comes to some sort of entertainment accompanied by sleight of hand,
mm-hmm.
and maybe some quick movement,
yes.
Which is not considered to be magic, of course,
yes.
There is no problem in it.
Mm-hmm.
The scholars have not opposed such practices, because we do see sometimes, we see some people mm-hmm. know some tricks.
Yes,
which they play actually to entertain you or maybe the audience, and it's just
based on the principle of misdirection, basically.
Yes,
misdirection, like they take the attention away of the audience to something else, and then they do something with the sleight of the hand,
yeah.
so that they would be tricked not to see the quick handwork, basically.
You're right. So that's not haram, magic, and yeah. There's no problem in it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh. There's another question I'd like to ask you, and that is it permissible to learn fortune-telling, geomancy, jaffa, and similar things, which tell about the unseen?
Well, in this time around, of course, people's knowledge of these sciences cannot be relied on. There is no absolute certainty with regards to what the people claim to know.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they claim to know something or to explore something which is unseen. And we do know that, we of course know that no one knows, no mm-hmm. one has knowledge of the unseen.
Yes.
And many people who claim that they can see what other people, normal people, cannot see, they are actually lying.
Yes, that's
and
charlatans.
Therefore, some scholars have said that such practices like Jafr and Jami' and many other traditional sciences, which cannot be claimed to be, cannot be considered to be sciences,
yes.
because people do not have in-depth knowledge of such things, and therefore when they come out and say they know Jafar,
mm-hmm.
well, the truth of the matter is that they do not know anything about mm-hmm. it. And so some people are made to believe that they know it and they can explore or maybe discover something which is invisible or not seen by other people. So basically, if there is a profound knowledge of these things, there's no problem
mm-hmm.
in Jafar and Jami'. But, of course, in this time around, as the Supreme Leader has stated in his Ajwibatul Istifta'at, he has said that people's knowledge of these sciences cannot be relied on. But, of course, there's no harm in learning sciences like, for example, Jafr or Raml, geomancy, as you said, in the proper way, provided that it does not lead to any vileness or any mischief.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to magic and conjuring. Sheikh Javid, you said that some of these sciences, in fact, they are true, and it's okay. It's permissible, basically, to train, learn, or teach it, right? Like, to have a kind of proper education, like the academic education. Like, for example, we have the science of astronomy.
Yes.
All right? And it's a very valid science, and it is studied, in fact, at academic centers, universities, as a field of study.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nothing wrong, as you said, with that. But we also have, I just wanted to ask my, or pose the other part of my question, and that is related to that non-academic or pseudo-scientific field of study, which is called astrology.
Astrology, yes.
Yes, but they also have some trace of truth in it. Like they say, for example, based on the position of this star or that planet, then you're going to experience, for example, a kind of hardship in near future, for example, like that. And you may do so, basically. right?
Yes.
Maybe even out of luck or based on chance or whatever reason you may think of, but that may happen.
That may happen.
All right. So what's the view on that?
Well, astrology is also not valid according to the religious authorities, because generally people who claim to have knowledge of astrology, they do not have knowledge of it.
Yes.
And therefore, people who sit at the side of the roads, especially I've been to the Indian subcontinent, where you see people sitting at the sides of the roads, and they just look at, for example,
the palm of their hand.
Yeah, at the lines of on the palm of your hand.
Yes.
And then also they ask your names. Okay, what the date of your birth and everything. And then they make some judgments about you and about your future. These judgments are not based on sound and concrete evidence.
Yes.
And therefore, they cannot be trusted. And people should not turn to such people for advice.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they will be misled. That's why Islam and the religious authorities do not encourage people to go to such people. Rather, they discourage instead. Mm.
And we also have psychology, which is very much close to these ideas. I should say the other way around. I mean, like astrology, those people who are trained in astrology, they get some kind of non-academic education in that. And they try to actually put their shoes in the place of psychologists. And sometimes they tell you about your secrets, about your life, which is, I mean, the hidden part of your life, which is only known to you, but they also know it somehow, some way. All right? So what about that? And also the psychology.
Well, I think just as the scholars have strongly stated that knowledge of the unseen is only with Allah and His awliya, or the Prophet and His imams, infallible imams, none other than those people, noble figures, know anything about what is not visible to the eyes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid.
Yes.
Thank you. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are touching on is still magic, or some of the jurisprudential laws concerning magic and conjuring based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you mentioned several times before the break, you know, the knowledge of the unseen is only with Allah, with God.
Allah
and nobody else can claim it.
And His prophets.
Yes, we have, you know, the actually the text in the Holy Scripture, I mean in the Quran, that it says that it is only with Allah.
With Allah.
When the Prophet is asked many times, multiple times, that whether he knows the unseen, and God tells him, just tell this to the audience.
And of course, the Prophet may know the unseen with the permission of
And that part of the unseen, not the whole thing.
Not the whole thing, right.
So would you please talk about the unseen? Because I think we need to pause a little bit on this, because, you know, some of the things that people say, like when the doctors tell you of your disease and the symptoms and the result of the symptoms that may, for example, lead to, let's say, dangerous situations or even death. It's a matter of life and death for medical situations. Or the astronomers, for example, they say there is a lunar eclipse, for example, ahead of the time, because they basically predict, but based on educated estimate, right?
Yes.
Not based on like some kind of the knowledge of the unseen.
You're right.
So I think we need to just, you know, talk a little about, maybe 1 minute we have, about the unseen. What is the unseen? Would you define it, please?
As you rightly mentioned, the doctors look at the symptoms. The symptoms tell them what the cause of the disease is.
Yes.
and they will prescribe certain medicine. Okay, the same is the case with people who claim to know something about what is other people do not know, the unseen, of course, and they ask you some questions. For example, when a woman goes to an astrologist and complains about her husband, the astrologist is very quick to say that, okay, your husband has certain problems. For example, he claims, he makes certain claims which makes the wife believe that he is true. For example, the husband is not has some affairs with some other people. He does not want to provide financial support because he loves someone else,
right?
And there is someone else in his heart. So these are some general claims made by the astrologist.
True.
Yeah, which is to some extent true.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot, and thank you for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to conjuring and magic based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh has been laid to rest in Qatar after he was assassinated by Israel in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The top U.S. security official says the Iranian leader's promise of revenge for Haniyeh must be taken seriously, as Iran has proven it can attack Israel. More civilians are killed in Israel's attacks on Gaza, where the total death toll from the war nears 39,000. 500. Our top story for this half hour: Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh has been laid to rest in Qatar after he was assassinated by Israel in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Haniyeh was buried in the city of Lusail, north of Doha. That came after thousands, including high-ranking regional representatives, attended a funeral prayer at the largest mosque in the Qatari capital. Earlier, another large funeral procession was held for Haniyeh in the Iranian capital, with a prayer service that was led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Haniyeh was assassinated in his accommodation in northern Tehran in the early hours of Wednesday. He was in Iran for the inauguration ceremony of President Masoud Pezeshkian.
The funeral of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh commenced with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leading the funeral prayers. Iranian and Hamas political figures, along with mourners, come together in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to take part in the ceremony. Politicians and citizens alike called for justice, assuring that the Israeli